I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Joe Illick. He is the Artistic and Executive Director of the Santa Fe Concert Association. And tomorrow, Tuesday, the 28th of February, he is giving a talk called Notes on Music, and it's all about Rossini at the United Church of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a birthday party for Rossini.
It is. When's his birthday?
It's really February 29th, but close enough.
He's a leap year boy?
He's a leaper.
I was reading about him, and I didn't even see that. That's super cool. Now, where do we start with Rossini? I forget that he's a contemporary, that he met Beethoven.
He did. Beethoven was deaf at the time, and I don't think Beethoven had been able to hear The Barber of Seville, but he said to Rossini, you should write more pieces like that.
So, I mean, he started early. He was one of these, would you call prodigies. Them child prodigies?
Absolutely, yes. And he began composing when he was six. There were the resources for him to do modest things, and as soon as he outstripped the resources, he had to move to a bigger place. He moved from one theater to another and pretty soon had contracts to write for four or five major theaters in Italy.
And so when you think about Rossini, what is the primary thing we think of him for? Is it all opera?
It's all opera. The things that we think of him for primarily are wit and his absolute love of melody and the human voice. He could turn any situation into a funny situation. And he wrote as many serious operas as he did comic operas. But these comic operas, mostly, are the ones that are done now. And they're just so well constructed in terms of setting up a situation which is inherently ridiculous and then letting it play out in musical terms.
Give us an example of one of those crazy situations that he sets up.
The Barber of Seville is, I think, the best known opera of Rossini out of the 38 or so operas that he wrote. And in The Barber of Seville, which is a play already by Beaumarchais, Rossini takes Beaumarchais' story and turns it into a situation that is perfect for operatic insanity. The man who is holding a young ward captive, because although he's three times her age, he wants to marry her, has two servants, and one of these servants is always sneezing, and one of them is always yawning, and the young love interest shows up because he wants to gain access to the beautiful young girl, and the old man is not smart enough to realize this at first. Of course, a perfect situation for operatic mistaken identity. Meanwhile, we have the conniving Figaro, the barber of Seville, Figaro, who has orchestrated the whole thing. So one crazy situation piles on top of another, and pretty soon we have seven singers all singing their ideas at once while a chorus of soldiers and police are outside. This is so typical of Rossini. Musically, he keeps a simple language, although, you know, in the early 19th century, he was fairly complex for the time. But it's not complexity that makes his work so rich. It's the fact that he can use these simple means, characterize a character in a way that shows us something about them that's different from everybody else, and pile the characters on top of each other so that each of their individual musical personalities comes through, even when six people are singing at once.
Does he incorporate things like sneezing and yawning into the
opera? Oh, he'll incorporate anything. Rossini, in a work he wrote when he was 18, already had the violins hitting their stands with the wood of their violin bows. I mean, he would use anything that was available to him.
What was he like as a person? He must have been kind of a guy you'd want to hang out with. He must have been hilarious.
He had the reputation for being very lazy. This is completely unjust because Rossini, when he was 20, wrote about seven operas in a year. He worked incredibly hard. He would turn out an opera for Venice and for Naples and for Rome, but he always loved to be in the company of other people. He was very sociable and a very quick-witted guy. So Rossini constantly worked and constantly made himself beloved wherever he went. He was happy in Italy up to a point until, for financial reasons, it was impossible for him to turn down an offer to go to Paris. And so when Rossini was about 30, he went to the Paris Opera, and they said, we'll pay you a huge sum of money to write two operas a year. Rossini negotiated, and he said, you could pay me twice as much, and I could write one opera a year, and the French agreed to this. And Rossini did this for 7 years, and then he said, you could pay me 10 times as much, and I could just live in Paris for the rest of my life and never write. And they said, that's fine.
Boy, the French really support the arts.
They really do. Let's all move to France. So Rossini wrote some of these big operas like William Tell and Siege of Corinth and Moses in Egypt and the Voyage to Reims and stuff while he was writing for the Paris Opera. You know, opera changed a lot in the early part of the 19th century. Rossini belonged to this school of vocal writing that we now call bel canto, which means beautiful singing. But Rossini had never heard that term applied to it, and neither had the two other most famous composers who wrote in that style, Donizetti and Bellini. But later, people looked back upon that era and they said, oh, this is when the beauty of singing was the whole point of opera. And so they called it, in retrospect, bel canto. Rossini was writing in this style, and it was a lighter kind of singing than what we hear on an opera stage nowadays. Because people were singing more lightly, they would also be able to sing more fluidly, quickly. Maybe you'll play a musical example that just in a minute shows the kind of very rapid coloratura or fioratura that Rossini expected of his singers. Of course, singers can still do this today, but there are singers who specialize in Rossini who are extraordinary in that respect. Meanwhile, as the 19th century went on and opera houses were larger, voices tended to be chosen because they were larger, orchestras were larger, Rossini could sense that the wave of musical future didn't include his style of music. So around 1829, when he wrote William Tell, he said, that's it, that's my last opera. And he lived another 40 years, but he never wrote another opera. Part of that was due to health problems, but part of that was because he could see that Meyerbeer and other composers were starting to write heavier operas that were becoming more popular. You can hardly blame Rossini. For 10 years, he had enjoyed the reputation of being the most popular opera composer in Europe. Sometimes half of a company's whole season would be made up of operas by Rossini. And he didn't want to go down slowly. He would rather retire in a way that left his reputation as being the great man of opera intact.
It's interesting that somebody would, instead of saying, I see where opera is going, I want to learn to write in the new style, just said, okay, I'm done.
It wasn't his style. He didn't feel he could write in the new style. You know, Meyerbeer operas were so gigantic, and Rossini had a respect for Meyerbeer, but during their lifetimes there was a fight, there was a feud between the admirers of Rossini and the admirers of Meyerbeer. And while Meyerbeer continued to write operas after Rossini had stopped writing operas, actually Meyerbeer died first, and Rossini was rather smug and happy about that. I think Meyerbeer's nephew it was who wrote a little funeral march for his uncle, and he brought it to Rossini and he said, hey, I have a funeral march for my uncle Meyerbeer who's died, and I wish you would look at this piece of music and tell me what you think. Well, you would expect Rossini would say, ha ha, I'm just so glad your uncle's gone. But he looked at this piece and he said, you know, truthfully, it would have been better if you had died and your uncle had written something for you.
Oh, boy. So let's listen to some of this style of singing that we call bel canto.
Okay, let's listen.
Intorno che
And we were just listening to mezzo-soprano Joyce Di Donato from La Donna del Lago, The Lady of the Lake, by Rossini. There's a Rossini opera that's going to be at the Santa Fe Opera this summer.
Yes, Santa Fe Opera is producing Maometto II. You know, there are, as I say, some 37 operas by Rossini, and maybe four or five of them are done with some regularity. The Barber of Seville, La Cenerentola, Italian Girl in Algiers. But Santa Fe Opera, wonderfully, is reviving an opera that is quite unusual. Now, if we knew every opera of Rossini by heart, which I confess I don't, you would recognize in many of them music from other Rossini operas. After all, if he had written an opera for Naples and 6 months later had to write an opera for Venice with a completely different public, the Venice public had not heard the opera in Naples, so Rossini would borrow quite liberally from himself. And I do know that in Maometto II, there's a piece of music that's exactly identical to a piece that Rossini uses again later in the Paris opera, Voyage to Reims. But Maometto II was one of the Italian operas, and it has the same marvelous use of the voice and dramatic situations. When you go to hear Maometto II, and I hope everybody will, you'll hear this kind of extraordinary singing that Rossini created. It's hard to imagine what opera in Italy was like before Rossini, because the traditions were very stuck, and Rossini just sort of breathed new life into everything. When he wrote The Barber of Seville, there already was a well-known opera on the subject of The Barber of Seville by Paisiello. And needless to say, because it was Italy, there was a huge demonstration at the premiere of Rossini's Barber of Seville. Somebody threw a cat on stage, and all kinds of crises occurred because the claque was so strong against Rossini. But by the second or third performance, The Barber of Seville by Rossini was a triumph, and it had eclipsed Paisiello's opera, which is now all but completely forgotten. Rossini had a way of taking a subject and finding an unexpected angle with which to tell the story. In his opera La Cenerentola, which means Cinderella, he decided he would eliminate all elements of the supernatural. So there's no pumpkin, no fairy godmother. He plays instead on the social elements that, at first, Cinderella is thought to be a low-class girl, and of course at the end, because she marries a prince, she's of a much higher class. And his whole opera is about European class struggle. It's not the only opera where he changed the story. Shakespeare's Othello, as you know, has a tragic ending, and when Rossini wrote it, he thought the audience would respond to it better if it had a happy ending, so he changed it.
That's amazing. He just made a new Othello and still called it Othello.
He did. And it's a gorgeous, wonderful opera. You know, there's a famous piece by Rossini called the Cat Duet, a duet for two cats. And just to show that Rossini would borrow from himself, the most famous tune from the Cat Duet is actually a very serious piece of music from his own opera, Otello. So Rossini himself once said that music itself, before it has words to it, is not inherently comic or tragic. It takes the situation on the stage and the text to make it one or the other. Now, that's not always true with other composers, but I think Rossini made good on that claim in his own work.
It's hard not to think of TV and cartoon music when you think of
the
Rossini.
Bunny of Seville.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I grew up with that.
Yeah, me too.
And the idea of the Lone Ranger being the William. Yeah, that's Rossini. And so it colors the way we hear it in the 20th, 21st century.
Well, it's so great that some of the most famous classical music was used in Hollywood and in the cartoons, because it's made it currency that we all recognize. And just the way the Ride of the Valkyries is something, you know, da-dum, 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 is Kill the Wabbit. So, yeah, this is great. I don't know who, whether it was Disney or somebody at that studio, clearly loved all this music, because not just the cartoons, but Fantasia and other things that they did used classical music liberally, used the best of classical music. So yes, there's definitely some Rossini that's in everybody's common vocabulary.
let's talk about opera as an art form in Rossini's time. He was born in 1792, lived through the major chunk of the 19th century. And when you talk about protests at operas and people throwing cats onto stage, it's a really different kind of opera audience and way of using
the
opera.
The Italians are very participatory, you know. It's just like a soccer match. So I only know from my personal experience that I once conducted Il Trovatore in Siena, and it was in a public square, the largest public square, and there were 32 or 3300 folding chairs set up, and all of them were full, and the orchestra and the sets and everything, and I were all there. And from the moment we started Il Trovatore, the audience sang along. I mean, they didn't wait for the singing. From the overture, they sang along till the end.
Really?
The Italians
own
opera.
Did it drive you crazy?
No, it's wonderful, because it's like officiating over a ritual or something, because they believe that they're part of it. You know, Italian opera is theirs. So when
Could you hear the opera singers?
Well, sure. You know, opera singers are loud.
True.
But you could also hear the audience audibly enjoying and participating and, you know, crying. And they were living along with it viscerally the whole time. So this business about throwing cats on stage, it's not because it was a political scandal. It's because the Italians felt that there was an artistic war going on, and they all wanted to participate. They wanted to take sides. So Paisiello had been beloved for two decades, and here was this young whippersnapper, Rossini, who was trying to write an opera on the subject of one of Paisiello's operas. So they were going to show him. But in the end, Rossini had the last laugh in that case. You know, there are a lot of operas now that we consider famous that at their premieres were total fiascos. The Italian public had a lot to do with that. They would judge not just an opera, but a singer very harshly. If they liked a singer, they would scream and ask for encore after encore and give a 10-minute standing ovation. And if they didn't like a singer, they would boo so loudly that the singer would be forced to leave the stage. So, you know, the Italians didn't need critics. They were all critics.
We're talking to Joe Illick of the Santa Fe Concert Association. You were talking earlier about bel canto, beautiful singing, and that's the style of music in which Rossini wrote. Does that apply to men and women equally?
Yes, yeah, no gender bias in bel canto. It essentially means that the accompaniment from the orchestra is fairly spare to allow the singer maximum freedom. It's as if in Bach and Handel and Mozart, the orchestra and the singer have a very clearly defined partnership. And then suddenly in this period between, say, 1812 and 1840, the singer becomes the rock star. And the orchestra plays a more subsidiary role, and the singer is allowed to take off and in fact, not only just sing the music that's written, but improvise and create the music on the spot, so to speak, which they really did. And it's interesting that the bel canto composers, Rossini and Bellini and Donizetti, would work with a specific singer and create pieces for that singer. In other words, if Mr. or Mrs. X could sing Runs Going Down much more impressively than Runs Going Up, then the piece would have Runs Going Down. So in a sense, the singer, the performer, was a co-creator of the piece. So it's completely justified in a modern production of Rossini to rewrite things to suit the gifted singer, you know, rather than to try to say, hey, you should make your voice exactly like this person who lived in 1830. It's better to say, here's what Rossini would have done, and rewrite the thing.
People actually, opera directors are rewriting things to this day.
Yes.
To suit the voice of the
yes.
singer.
Yes, because it was traditional that the first time a beautiful melody came, it would be sung just as it was written. But in this style of opera, that melody will come back, and when it comes back, then it can be ornamented. And it's there where the ornaments are tailored to suit the gifts of the particular singer.
Let's hear something of the male version, so we're not showing gender bias, of this bel canto singing style.
Great.
Lontana
and yet another example of Bel Canto of Rossini sung by Juan Diego Flores. Now, you, Joe Illich, are doing this program called Notes on Music, and you do all sorts of notes on music, this one about Rossini. What do you do? I mean, people assemble in the church. You start talking, and you start playing music also.
I do. And in this particular Notes on Music, I have two real singers, which is a treat, because sometimes I'm singing, and you already know what that sounds like. But the idea of Notes on Music is just to make classical music entertaining, accessible, understandable, and above all, not scary. You know, here's one of the great treasures of civilized world, and many people feel that it's not available to them because they think they need some kind of strange key to understanding it.
They need to be part of the club.
There's no club. We're all part of the club. But Notes on Music is just a way to bring everybody that wants to into the club.
So you're going to be playing piano, having singers, giving examples.
And I'll be telling Rossini's life story and talking about things that he did. The two singers are both Rossini experts. They're opera stars who sing Rossini extraordinarily well. It's a mezzo-soprano named Alyssa Anderson and a tenor named Javier Abreu. Alyssa Anderson was an apprentice at Santa Fe Opera a few years ago, and in the Benjamin Britten opera Albert Herring, the mezzo Jill Grove, wonderful singer, was sick one night, and Alyssa was her cover, so Alyssa jumped in and sang a major role in Albert Herring, and she was a big hit. So it's great to have her back in that way. We're just going to do arias and a duet so that people can really hear what Rossini singing live is like and maybe get a feeling for what some of the fuss was about.
All I know about opera, which is admittedly very little, I know from watching the Santa Fe Opera over the last few years and talking to Desiree Mays, as we'll be doing again this year, about the operas, one of which this coming year is Rossini. But one thing that has become clear is that the role of acting and theater changed dramatically between the Baroque and the Romantic period. So you have some of these Baroque operas where they basically, it's almost like modified concerts where they're standing on stage and singing. And then later you've got La Traviata and La Boheme, which are basically theater pieces.
And yes. That's such an interesting question, Mary Charlotte. You know, we don't have videos of singers from the 18th century. But I think in every era, there were some singers who had a charismatic gift and some who didn't. And so we have this feeling that acting in opera is a new discovery. But I don't think that's true. There was a movie not too long ago called Farinelli about a castrato who was a rock star and a millionaire of his era in the 18th century. What was extraordinary that came across in that film is that he had that acting charisma. Great performers have always had it, I think. Obviously, some singers have a longer suit vocally and a shorter suit acting-wise, and others are fantastic actors who are good singers. But to find that rare combination of a singer who is both an extraordinary actor and an extraordinary singer is rare in any era. Okay, Rossini was married to one of the great mezzo-sopranos of the early 19th century, a Spanish mezzo named Isabella Colbran, and he wrote a lot of his operas for her. That's why Rossini heroines, unlike most operatic heroines who are sopranos, are mezzo-sopranos. They're lower voices. Of course, mezzo-sopranos have been thanking Rossini for that ever since. When Rossini wrote these mezzo showpieces, he was really on new territory. People had seen the hierarchy of operatic heroes and heroines very clearly. The heroine was a soprano. So Rossini changed that too.
The way you were talking about it before, there are also just really great stories. And so if the people who are taking these roles are theatrically inclined, there would have to be quite a bit of great theater happening on stage.
Yeah, well, the paradox in Rossini is that there are wonderful, funny situations which call for lots of marvelous acting, which the singers do, and then there are wonderful musical numbers where seemingly, at least just to look at the score, the action comes to a dead halt. Rossini said to Wagner later, because, you know, Rossini was 20 years older than Wagner, and they were talking. And Rossini said, you know, when I was a young man, we just lined up the singers at the front of the stage like seven artichokes and let them let them sing a big ensemble.
Did you really say seven artichokes?
Seven artichokes. So he was aware that there was this kind of split personality in opera between the story is moving on and then suddenly there's a concerted number. But directors, of course, have become very ingenious in finding ways to make these parts of operas that, you know, in old days were fairly static into equally lively parts, because a modern audience is more demanding of being constantly visually engaged. It would have been interesting to be at a concert 200 years ago, because audiences thought nothing of sitting in the theater for 6 hours, and they would frequently be watching the opera, but there were plenty of other things to do too. There were dining tables in the boxes, and the theaters were connected to casinos. Rossini was a smart businessman, and he always had it as part of his contract that he would take a percentage from the casino's earnings, and that's how opera companies paid for themselves in Italy in that time. Probably would be a good idea for us to do that again now.
Yeah, really. So Rossini, along with everything else, I mean, from the portraits of him that survive, it looks like he also had an excellent appetite.
He did, and he became, after he retired from opera composing, a famous chef. You've probably been in a restaurant more than once and seen Tornados Rossini on the menu. That was one of the many dishes that he actually created. He decided that, you know, if he couldn't write the kinds of operas that he wanted, he would change his life. So he became one of the great entertainers of Parisian society. And it was always the highest compliment to receive an invitation to one of Rossini's soirees, where the music would usually be Rossini and the food would always be Rossini.
Joe Illick is artistic and executive director of the Santa Fe Concert Association, and he will be giving notes on music, and that is both Joe and two opera singers who will be there at the United Church of Santa Fe at 1804 Arroyo Chamiso, 7:30 tomorrow night, Tuesday the 28th of February. And I thought we could go out with something that maybe everybody knows, or maybe they don't, and maybe you haven't heard it for a while, but the overture to The Barber of Seville.
I just want to tell you that Rossini wrote this overture to two other operas first. First, it served as the overture to Queen Elizabeth, which was a serious opera that he wrote, and then Aureliano in Palmira, an opera that also didn't have the success he would have liked. So thank God he finally attached it to an opera that lasts today, so that we can still hear this wonderful overture.
And I have to say, I suppose non-opera fans know him best for his overtures.
I think so, because they happen on concert programs. This overture, like many of Rossini's overtures, exploits a trick that he developed, the Rossini crescendo, where suddenly the orchestra drops down to a whisper and a small melody is played and begins to get louder and louder until it dominates everything. So here's the Barber of Seville overture, complete with Rossini crescendos.
Joe Illick, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
Thanks.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Billy Blair. She's a visiting lecturer with University of New Mexico School of Public Administration, and we are here to talk about a conference that's coming up called Governing in the New Media Age. It's on Friday, the 2nd of March, this coming Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you always. Now, this is a conference basically to kind of get people up to speed, even people who may think they are up to speed, on what's going on digitally and how we can access information. Who is this geared toward?
This conference would be of interest to anyone who's doing public policy advocacy, to people who are public information officers, particularly in government agencies, to people in the media, and to the general public, because it's going to address what is the new normal in digital information delivery.
What is the new normal?
The new normal. I wish I knew. I'm going to know after Friday, after the conference. As you know, it ranges from everything to tweeting, to blogging, to information at the speed of light.
So you're going to have people talking about subjects like, for example, if you want to know what's going on in your government, whether you're a journalist or whatever you're doing, there are ways to access information, government information, without going down to the crazy dusty archives and signing in and making Xerox copies and all that stuff that we used to always do.
People don't even do that anymore, do they, Mary Charlotte? People just go on their computers and look for that information. And it is going to be to help the public know how to get information, but primarily it's designed for people who distribute information, people who work for government agencies, who are public information officers, who have to keep people advised on what's going on in their agencies, for media people, and for people in nonprofits, political groups, who are advancing public policy issues.
So information that you get online is only as good as the people who are organizing it and presenting it.
That precisely is one of the issues, and we're actually having a panel discussion on that. We're going to have Tripp Jennings, who's a reporter with the Santa Fe New Mexican, and who was one of the founders of the Independent, which was an online presence.
Right, that came to a sad end a little later, late last year.
Sadly, yes. And we're going to have Gotti Schwartz from KOB Television, who are going to talk about more traditional news-gathering methods and ways that we have done that, ways that stories are vetted, ways that people know that they can trust that information, as compared to the tweets, the blogs, the other types of information delivery that we have today. It's very interesting, to have Tripp and Gotti doing this, because I think of them as the kind of the hip with it young journalists themselves, who both, as you probably know, tweet, and we can follow them all the time.
I just started tweeting, and it's one of those media that you have to be on it all the time. And I guess for people who do breaking news, it's perfect.
It's perfect for them, and as for me, I am a Twitter voyeur. While I have an account, I follow other people.
Uh-huh. There is the question for people who are journalists that is always looming and has been there for as long as there's been journalism, is how much work are you going to do? There is this factor of people who, I mean, there's a lot, a big problem that we have in journalism today is people just report what other people say instead of verifying it and digging for that information themselves. In theory, digging for that information, or at least some of it, could be a little easier now. Is that true or not?
Getting information is easier now. The information that goes out, as you just pointed out, we cannot always count on its veracity. And that's one of the reasons we're going to actually have a discussion at the very close of our day, which is going to feature Doug Turner. Doug Turner is the CEO of D.W. Turner, an agency in Albuquerque. You may also remember he was a Republican gubernatorial candidate several years back. He consults internationally. And Representative Brian Egall from here in Santa Fe discussed the issue of, is governing better because of new media? Or actually, has it affected it the other way?
Or has it affected it at all?
or has it affected it at all?
I mean, the thing that we would like to hear about is backroom deals. We would like to hear about stuff that's kind of done around the margins of government, and that's where the digging has to go on the part of journalists. Otherwise, politicians start doing whatever they want, helping their friends, and so on, and then you get into problems of corruption, which nobody's going to post on the internet in the first place.
Well, that's a good point. The digging and the context is what traditional media have brought us, which the new digital media may not be quite there yet.
What have you learned, Billy, in preparing this conference that you didn't know before?
I've learned how out of it I am. I've learned because in talking to some of these very bright young people who are going to be presenters at the conference, and I say something like send me a short bio. And traditionally, people who presented our conferences for UNM are academics or government officials, and they give you this detailed one-page bio with their education and all these details. These folks are so used to, I think, tweeting and sending a quick email. In fact, I'm told email is now out of vogue, that they send me three sentences about who they are, and they don't mention their education.
And how is that okay?
I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying that's the way they're delivering information. And yeah. I hope to learn more from them. Because one of the things that, in doing some research for the conference, I found is that 96% of millennials of that generation are involved in social networking of some type.
Well, much to learn. The conference is called Governing in the New Media Age. It's at the Hotel Santa Fe this coming Friday, March 2nd, from 8:30 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. For more information, people can go online to dce.unm.edu, and you can also call 505-277-0077. Anything else you want to let people know?
I think if you want to be really hip and on the cutting edge and know how to get your point across, whether you're a public information officer or a policy advocate or a journalist working in today's environment, this is a do not miss event.
Billy Blair is a visiting lecturer at the University of New Mexico School of Public Administration. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome to the show Christopher Johnson. He's a poet and performer, and on February 29th, he is doing a special event. It's a leap year dinner theater event at Counterculture here in Santa Fe called Skips Day. It's an audience participation play, which Christopher has written. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to welcome Crockett Bodelson and Sandra Wang of the Caldera Gallery, which is in the same little complex as Counterculture Restaurant. They are with the gallery, and they're also a collaborative artist duo named Scuba. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
So let's talk about this play, Skips Day. What's it about? How does it work? Is it about leap year?
Well, yes and no. The plot line that drives it through is that it's a high school class that is happening on leap day. And one of the boys in the class named Alexander, who his classmates call Skip, is celebrating his birthday. But the play is more specifically about that certain type of blindness teens can have, wherein they think that they know a lot about the world, that they're becoming adults, but all of the stuff, in a certain sense, is only relevant insofar as it affects them as individuals, rather than having a broader view of the world, which sounds kind of odd. But mostly it's about, you know, the type of high school attitude and the way high schoolers can be center of the universe type feelings.
Yes. Yeah. And so what's the audience participation part?
Well, anyone in the audience is by default a high school student. They'll be sitting with the rest of the high school kids. They are required to, if they are called upon, respond from their homework, which is a fact about leap day. And they don't have to worry because we'll do their homework for them in this case, not necessarily in the future. And they're going to be encouraged to, you know, get in on some tomfoolery with us, act like high school kids, not pay attention to the teacher. We have a teacher for the class. So
Laird Hovland. He's a local artist and sculptor.
Okay. Now, what is your role as artists and Caldera gallerists?
Well, the cups will be thrown by Chris Brodsky.
Now, cups, everybody gets a cup?
Everybody who buys a ticket gets a ceramic cup as a token to remember the event by. On that cup will be written Leap Day facts. For example, Tony Robbins, the motivator speaker, is born on Leap Day. And other local events that have occurred on February 29th will be written on the cups.
Okay.
And at some point, people will get called on, and they will have to read off that information. We're also realizing that people will just start talking about that information. You know, what's on your cup? This is on my cup. So it will create this kind of classroom atmosphere where people are talking about this issue, Leap Day, and the events that have occurred on these days.
And so how much is it scripted and how much is it evolving, Christopher, as it goes along?
Well, the parts that you might say are evolving are pseudo-scripted. We know where they arise, where it's appropriate for us to engage the audience and really draw them into the sense of being high school kids. But about 60 to 70% of it is scripted lines. The dinner theater will last 45 to 55 minutes, the idea being it's as long as a high school class. And so we do have some loops in there where we get a little off task, you might say. And that's where the audience would participate with us. And the more we get off task, the more likely it is they will be called upon to answer from their homework assignments by the teacher. So.
And all of this is at Counterculture, and not only is there dinner theater, but there's dinner. And the menu looks really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
New Mexico beef with red wine, roasted garlic mashed potatoes, and I guess the alternative entree is spinach lasagna with Caesar salad, toasted focaccia, and then nice little dessert. And all good stuff, and you go home with a hand-painted ceramic cup by Caldera Gallery. Right.
Correct.
Well, if people would like more information, what's the website?
It's www.calderasantafe.com/skipsday.
Okay. Well, it's great to have you all on the air. Christopher Johnson, Crockett Bodelson, and Sandra Wang of the Caldera Gallery. And we will see you on the 29th of February.
Thank you so much.